Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy, I don't even know. I have no idea what to put for this week. We've lost the basketball game and some other stuff. I don't know.
Happy Chucks might die this week. Although, did that vote already, like, get turned down?
It didn't get turned down. It got delayed. To February, if I'm not mistaken.
Gotcha. Right. We'll get to that later. First and foremost, we can talk about, you know, I think we're doing everyone a favor by putting the Syracuse stuff front-loaded. That way, if you don't feel like finishing this podcast with the non-Syracuse stuff, which sometimes creeps up, and by sometimes, I mean all the time, you get at least 30 minutes of solid orange talk. I think that's a fair compromise for everyone to know.
I think that works.
Yeah. So Syracuse lost to North Carolina on Monday. It wasn't close. Then it looked close for a second. And then it finished not close.
Yeah, I mean, I think we actually have it down to three at one point, like midway through the second half.
Yeah, it was like three or four.
It actually kind of reminded me of last year's Final Four game, to be honest. Like, where, like,
Cooney put on the superhero cape for like a three-minute stretch, and then it all went to shit.
Yeah. A weird game. Like SU played pretty good offense in the second half, but just could not get a stop. I think there was a point where Syracuse is like scoring like almost every time down the floor and somehow not gaining on UNC for a while. Like,
nope.
It was a bizarre game. UNC is just a lot better, which I think we knew going in, so nothing too shocking. It would have been a nice one to pick up in our effort to climb the mountain that we've put ourselves at the bottom of, or I guess out of the hole that we've dug ourselves is a better metaphor. Nothing too shocking. It seems like we kind of know what team we have now. It's a very short rotation. It's just surprise to everyone. One that's like weirdly efficient offensively, but the defense is just nowhere near where Syracuse fans are accustomed to. So, and you know, still struggling to really get the, I mean, they've had some nice, a pair of decent wins, but there's no need to pick up some big wins, I think, and it's, you know, Monday was close for a bit, but they're clearly a ways behind where, like, a UNC is.
Yeah, and you know what? I feel like defense, yes, we gave up a ton of points against North Carolina, but I don't really feel like the defense was that bad, all things considered, against UNC. I felt like that was more a product of just they're one of the best, if not the best, rebounding team in the country. They were just able to kill us on the glass. Obviously, if you're going to have Lydon at the five for extended periods of time, that's just kind of how it's going to go. But I'd rather have him at the five since I feel like the offense and the defense rolled better. Coleman, whatever his knee issues, obviously not helping either. So having him and Roberson is kind of the guys that we have to rely upon more than anyone else. In terms of the boards, that's... it's not sustainable, and you know, this is what we talked about, you know, a couple weeks ago when we started seeing Lydon at the five, was that you can hang with most teams like this, but you're not going to be able to hang with a team like North Carolina that's big in the middle and is able to crash the way they are.
Yeah, I mean, they beat us on the boards, like, just in terms of raw rebounds by 20. They had 18 offensive rebounds, which is as many as we had defensive, which is not a good sign. I mean, they just have a really, really nice front court depth, and Syracuse does not. And I agree that Lydon is probably the best option at the five. I really don't think that, like, even a healthy Coleman would have made a huge difference here. And that's, like, you know, that's the list, unless you want to put Thompson at the five, which is not any better or different.
Probably worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's no different in terms of, like, the size of the team. It was funny because I think I had a conversation with some people after the game. It's like, was it the worst-case scenario that Tyler Lydon went nuts against, like, the best team we've played so far and Syracuse also didn't come close to winning? Because, like, I don't think it's right to root against Lydon having a good game like that. But we've discussed, like, if Lydon isn't going to have a huge season, maybe it ends up kind of doing this, like, hard reset thing with the scholarship numbers and the talent numbers and the depth. Lydon's throwing 26 on 14 shots against UNC. And grabbing seven boards, not the best if that is your hope. But again, I think that puts you in a weird position to, like, root against your best player being good, which I don't know that I feel comfortable with.
No, not at all. And we've said this too. Like, if Syracuse could bury whatever the hell the non-conference schedule was and play the way they've played, I think since the first BC game, I think we'd be happy with that no matter what happens. If they make the NIT, great. If they don't, fine. If they go on some miracle run and get themselves to the tournament, even better. But I don't really think that this Syracuse team is going to revert back to what it was, pre-BC game. So I think since January 2nd, what we've seen from this orange squad, and whether that means Tyler Lydon scores a lot or not, I think the book's written for him in terms of scouting report. NBA teams know what they would be getting out of him, and he's played his way into a first-round talent. I don't know what could play him out of the first round at this point, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of, like, how many people come out, because it is supposed to be a deep draft, but you figure, you know, he can go to the combine, which he should, which everyone should, honestly. Like, there's no real reason not to, aside from the fact that it'll probably drive Bayheim crazy in terms of figuring out late scholarships, but that's no one on the team's concern. Yeah, it's going to be tricky. I think maybe the best you could hope now is that Battle stays and Battle has, like, a huge second year, which I don't know that we've seen enough from. I mean, he's played pretty well in recent weeks, but I don't know that he's done anything that, like, jumps off the page as, like, a one-and-done type player, so maybe that's the hope. But
especially in a deep draft, I think that's the one caveat for him and Thompson, is that they're guys who maybe in, like, a crappier draft or a more shallow draft, at least, you know, get hot at the right time, and suddenly you're playing yourself into a top 50 or so pick. But yeah, it looks like, knock on wood, that both of those guys can stick around for the time being, which is kind of a necessity now based on what we're seeing from the incoming recruiting class and what we're seeing in terms of just the raw numbers of guys who are leaving.
Yeah, I mean, assuming you're obviously losing Gillen and White, you're losing Roberson, you're losing Coleman. You get Chukwu back, but who knows what he'll be. You know, maybe he turns, you know, maybe he's 2012 Fab Mello after Fab's freshman year and he goes nuts, but
nice.
I think that'd be nice. I wouldn't put it in pen. So yeah, them staying is huge. If not, like, then Syracuse has, like, a true rebuild year next year and needs to take a huge class, and then that's, like, then we're in, like, really uncharted territory, in terms of, like, the team is going to be all freshmen. And that can be fun in, like, some ways, as, you know, the expectations will be as low as possible, unlike this year when they were really not. They were quite high. But it's still not what you want to see at the back end of Boeheim's tenure. You want to see him competing for titles.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's always at the backdrop of this season, and something that I'm probably going to write about once the dust settles on this season and the recruiting class, too, is, like, this obviously paints a weird picture. This plus the Final Fours paints a weird picture of the end of the Boeheim tenure, and it's one that I'm sure, you know, is going to be intriguing and terrifying all at once. I don't know what to make of it all, but there's still a lot of time. I mean, for all we know, I doubt Tyler Lydon sticking around, but for all we know, something changes. He decides that he has more to play for at the collegiate level or whatever. I think that there's a lot of time still to play out in the season, and a lot of time still to play out in terms of these guys' college careers, whether it's 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years more beyond this one. Focusing ourselves a little bit on the immediate term, Dan, we have a very big game on Saturday at a place that we have not played particularly well, Notre Dame. They're tied for first right now in the ACC. They lost to Florida State tonight. Which, Dan, do you think that helps our case or hurts our case if we have any shot of upsetting the Irish?
I don't know. Along with Florida State, really, Notre Dame is probably, like, the surprise team of the ACC. I don't think a lot of people had them being all that great this year. I think they were kind of projected to be middle of the pack in the league. And they look great. I mean, they play better defense than they did last year. They're super efficient offensively. They spread the floor like they always do. It's actually a really fun team to watch if you can get by, like, the general hatred of all things Notre Dame that a lot of people have, which probably not gonna be easy. But, like, just look up and down the roster. It's a lot of names that you'll notice from these, like, last couple Notre Dame teams which have done well in the tournament, which is a weird thing to say after the entire history of Notre Dame before that. But Bonzi Colson, just a really fun like old school low post player, Steve Asturia, who, you know, classic annoying white guy, Matt Farrell, VJ Beachum. Like, that's as good a 1-4 as you'll see. It actually kind of reminds me of, like, maybe almost like those Virginia teams in terms of, like, there's no one, like, overwhelms you with, like, what they do scoring-wise. Obviously, you know, those who watch the games knew that they had some great players, like Brogdon and Joe Harris, but, like, no one was really, like...
Group.
Right, it was a really well-rounded team, and one, like, or even, like, I'm not going to say they're the 2010 Syracuse team, but, like, just in the way that team had, like, six guys that all averaged, what, like, 13 to 15 points. This isn't that, because that team was...
American.
Yeah. But, like, you know, there are four super dangerous players, and even, like, a Rhett Pfluger on the bench, or one of those other guys can come up and bite you a little bit. So, it's a good team, and the Joy Center is a really, really difficult place to play, as Syracuse has learned a number of times in big spots. So I don't love Syracuse's chances, to be honest, and it's not even as much about Syracuse as it is. I think Notre Dame's actually really good.
Yeah, I mean, they're too good. That pisses me off. They become, and I'm not going to turn this into a Notre Dame podcast, but I certainly feel like Notre Dame's turned a little bit of a corner. I feel like not just us, but a lot of people just kind of doubt them to no end every year when they have to replace big names and kind of reshuffle the deck chairs. And yet for the past few seasons, Notre Dame's really managed to do it very well. I mean, the last two Notre Dame teams, I'd say going into the season, overachieved. Maybe 2 years ago, not as much, but last year, definitely. Bray has become a coach who, I think, went from, you know, first-round flameouts to a guy that really is knocking on the door of his first Final Four, and debatably maybe should have gotten it a couple years ago against that Kentucky team. I think the effort they put in against that Wildcat squad that was undefeated to that point was commendable. I felt like it kind of set up a little bit of a blueprint for what Wisconsin was able to do to them in Indianapolis in the Final Four. In general, this Notre Dame team has found a way to, I mean, better than Syracuse, better than a lot of others, able to just kind of shuffle guys in and out year to year. Granted, they have a lot better chance of having, you know, 3 and 4 year guys than Syracuse does at this point, and a lot of other power programs do at this point. But they created a system that works for them, and it's only a matter of time before they're able to break through. And maybe this is the year. I mean, this Notre Dame team does look very, very good in a lot of facets of the game. They're not an elite rebounding team, but they're not a terrible rebounding team. They seem to do everything just good enough. And offensively seem to do things better than they have, at least in the last couple seasons.
Yeah, I mean, the things that stand out to me is they have just a number of shooters, which is not a surprise. They've done that, you know, a lot recently. If they have four guys in their rotation over 40% as a team, they're 39.5%. But the scariest part is that, and actually Syracuse is the same way. It's just hilarious that Syracuse is not great, and this is always the Achilles heel. Syracuse shoots really, really well from the line. Notre Dame is right there. And their top three guys, their top three scorers, Colston, Vasturia, and Farrell, all shoot over 86%. Steve Vasturia is 91.5% from the line, which is just ridiculous. As a team, they're just under 83%. So, like, they shoot well from every level. They're 47% from the field, 82.8% from the line, and 39.5% from three. Like, that's pretty damn good as a team. And they spread the floor. They run a pretty attractive style. So yeah, it's not going to be. I imagine this Notre Dame team will be pretty well situated to attack the zone, at least based on their makeup and the fact that they're not like the classic like Pitt, like feed it inside, get it to the line, kick it back out. North Carolina actually does a nice job of that, as we saw. They kind of go for more of the bomb over the top approach, and it either works really well or doesn't. And we've seen, you know, both in like back to back years, we've seen like Notre Dame will knock off a much more talented Syracuse team, or then like lose by 25 a year later with the same roster. But if that's going to be their strategy, this isn't the worst one to try that with. And then when you have a guy like Colson inside, I'm very worried about Lydon's foul situation, which he's been pretty good about keeping manageable this year. But Colson will take you on the block, and he's kind of a bulldozer, so that'll be interesting to watch.
Undoubtedly, yeah. I think that this is going to be a weird matchup. I don't think that I think Notre Dame's shooting the ball well from three. I wouldn't say that they're thriving from three in the same way some other teams that have kind of picked us apart have. I think that there are some interesting matchups here. I think in general, you know, you're going to be keying in on. I think that this is almost the issue, but it's one you've kind of alluded to, that there's no one you can really just kind of hone in on and say, like, you're going to be the guy that's going to kill us from three. You know, it could be Farrell, it could be Beecham. There's a variety of other guys all hitting around the same percentage from three, and that's going to spread this defense thin very quickly. And yeah, I think that more than anything else is why I'm concerned, is because there is no, I mean, not like we've made a habit of guarding that guy, whoever he may be, in terms of, you know, the hot 3-point shooter. But yeah, if you have multiple guys that could hit from beyond the arc, it doesn't bode well for what this defense has struggled with.
Yeah, I mean, just overall, like, this defense, you know, it's not great. It's probably the worst one Syracuse has had in a while, and it's not hard to see why, just based on the inexperience in running the zone. So there have been moments where it's looked really good, and there have been, like, stretches where, like, even in the beginning of the set, when Syracuse went on its run on Monday, it did a nice job of getting out in transition and forcing, you know, iffy shots and whatnot. But I just am not too keen on depending on Notre Dame taking bad shots. I don't think that's going to be their game. So this one could be a rough one, or, you know, we could see a weird thing. We've seen Syracuse teams beat teams that they shouldn't in the past, and we see weird games all the time. So we'll see. It's a good test, because if they do pick off Notre Dame, I mean, that's a really nice win.
Well, that's the one that's eluded us to this point. And that's
right.
Kind of where, like, you know, I said the other day, and I know Ben did too on the site, like, that's what kind of cools off any sort of can we make the tournament talk. I mean, even if we go 6-6 down the stretch and only beat the unranked teams, that's not a tournament resume. I don't care if...
No, not even close.
Yeah, I don't care if you're a team that's sitting around, like, the 17-14 mark with, what will we have, 9 wins in the ACC at that point? Something like that,
yeah.
So we'd be 17-14, we'd be 9-9 overall. That's not a tournament resume if you have losses to Boston College, St. John's, every ranked team you've faced, every road game you've played. There is no wiggle room if you don't win at least 2 of the ranked teams, which, like I said in that post about SU ceiling, means you have to go 8-4. And even then, there are no guarantees this year with what looks like a very messy bubble.
8-4, and I still would not feel comfortable unless Syracuse won at least, like, probably like 2 games in the ACC tournament.
Yeah, I think that's what I alluded to too. I think we'd be looking at 8-4, so you have to go 10-4 down the stretch. That would include at least 3 ranked wins, probably. That puts you at 21? That puts you at 21 wins, which now we're talking about something. And I think 11-7 in the ACC at least raises some eyebrows. But yeah, I think in 2 weeks, if we can still even mention this as a possibility, then maybe I start buying it. Until then, I think it's all a bit of a pipe dream, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's why I'm kind of comfortable just assuming that Syracuse, you know, I think we all know Syracuse is on the outside looking in, if you can even call it that. Like, maybe they're across the street looking at the house. But now I think with that kind of sobering view, you can kind of see it, you know, lay these things out without getting overly optimistic. Because, like, there's no way I think we're going 10-4 down the stretch, but, like, in that universe, if that exists, maybe that's what would lead Syracuse back to the tournament. And I think it would help that people will freak out if Syracuse finishes in, like, what, sixth in the ACC or something and doesn't make the tournament. I think there will be a lot of people beating the drums for, you know, this team clearly had all these transfers, had all these freshmen, peaked at the right time. Boeheim knows what he's doing. Boeheim will be all over, like, he'll be on PTI, like, 5 times in March, talking about his team. So, I mean, hopefully we get there. Hopefully we put ourselves in a position to get disappointed by the selection committee and not by just our general mediocre team.
Agreed. Before we get to halftime, maybe just a quick look at some ACC things in basketball. And then we can get to Dan and I's preferred topic of football. In the second half, like we mentioned, Florida State knocked off Notre Dame tonight. Florida State is 17-2.
They're really good.
Yeah, they're very, very good. I know a couple years ago we were talking about, you know, how they were bringing in better recruiting classes, and we weren't seeing that pay off in terms of an NCAA tournament resume or tournament caliber teams. This is the payoff with that, obviously. When you have, you know, three or four very, very talented guys, I mean, Dwayne Bacon is the real deal. Everyone knew that going in. I think Florida State looks like a top 10 to 15 team right now, and that should scare the hell out of us down the line. Virginia, Louisville, Duke, these are teams with 2 and 3 losses in league play. I don't think that should scare you off from these teams also being top 15 caliber. I mean, we talked about it early in the year, and we said that you know, the depth at the top for the ACC was bar none best in the country. We included ourselves in that. The fact that we're not in that, and that you could probably add a couple names to the list. I mean, everybody in the ACC right now has at least 10 wins except for Wake and BC.
And those teams, like, well, I haven't really watched much Wake, but BC is like, better. They're not good. They're way better than they were last year. Even, you know, and that's a team that, you know, obviously blew out Syracuse and then got blown out by Syracuse. But even in the blowout loss, like, that's a much better team than BC's been since we joined the ACC.
Oh, completely agree. I think this BC team is miles, miles ahead. And, you know, Christian was going to get fired if – he still might, but Christian was going to get fired if they endured another season like last year. This might keep him around if he can get them to around – if he can go 12-19, I think he stays.
I would find it very hard to fire him considering how bad things have been there after seeing, like, pretty – it might be a kind of a jump to say stark improvement, but it feels like stark improvement.
Yeah, like I'm gonna go with stark improvement.
It's tough because they're like 12-19 is not good, but it's so much better than what they were. I think you got to move at least another year if that happens.
It's just it's tough, and I think that like this is the same issue that like BC's having with Adazio is like you had a step forward, but was it enough of a step forward given the schedule?
Yeah, it's tricky, and I'm sure BC fans aren't going to, like, freak out about 12-19, because it's not like they, you know, it's not like they were good 2 years ago. Like, it's like, oh, this is marginally better than the already bad, like, and in the ACC, there's this expectation of, you know, an ACC job opens up, and you can go get a really good coach, and that, you know, Jim Christian was okay hire at the time, but I don't think anyone else was, like, freaking out about it.
I thought hated it.
Yeah, I thought I was more inspired by the hire before, the former Cornell coach whose name is escaping me, who clearly didn't work. we are a very well fact-checked podcast here.
Facts only, no spin zone.
If we don't know a guy's name because he had a really nice year at Cornell where they went to the Sweet 16 and then was awful at Boston College, we will not pretend like we don't know his name, that we do know his name.
Pitt's in last place in the ACC.
That's hilarious. Because Pitt's not that bad either. It's not great for us. It's Steve Donahue.
Oh, yeah. Which sounds like a Boston College coach.
I'm shocked they haven't just, like, kissed and made up with Alice Dinner.
I mean...
he's at Kennesaw State? Come on.
Is he?
Yeah, apparently.
Owls rising. Owls, their football team launches this fall.
Yes, that's a thing. That's a thing that is definitely in line with this general podcast.
Yeah, Syracuse, schedule them now before it's too late.
They're not jumping. They're what, doing FCS for a couple years? Is that what the plan is?
Well, they're not jumping at all. I just want them to schedule them from an assured win FCS standpoint versus what we've like done in the past with like, oh hey, let's schedule Villanova.
But they're in FCS right away, right? They're not like starting D2 or something.
No, they're gonna play. I think they're gonna play a full fledged FCS independent schedule this year, and then next year they'll be in the Southern Conference, maybe, either Southern or something like that. One of those leagues. I know it's not I know it's not whatever the one that you and I have marveled at before.
Oh, the conference that has both, like, San Diego and the Pioneer Conference.
Yeah, the Pioneer Conference, which is just like a funny...
That's San Diego and, was it Marist?
San Diego, Marist, a bunch of others, Drake.
The rapper Drake is also in the conference.
He is. His helmets have a mix of his face and the Toronto Raptors logo on them.
Oh, my God.
It's a fantastic logo. other weird things in the ACC, Clemson's a good team, but they're 1-4 in league play. Virginia Tech is a better than us team, and they're 2-3 in league play.
Which people did not expect, is because they've been bad, and what's his name is like not Josh Pastner. Never really been a good coach.
No, never.
It's funny, I think Pastner really got by on, like, he looks like he's 15 and he's a guy after Calipari, and he's never actually won anything. No. He recruits okay. Or he did at Memphis, but maybe, like, I don't know, it'd be really weird to me if he ends up being good at Georgia Tech. It wouldn't make that much sense, as Memphis is a much easier place to win.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you there. NC State is
weird.
Is probably going to fire Gottfried.
That'd be really funny. Remember when Gottfried, this is, like, completely, has nothing to do with anything. Remember when Gottfried had it coached?
I thought you were going to say when he pissed when we got there.
Well, no, yes, but he did that when he had never actually coached in the ACC yet. Like, he got hired and then was talking like he was, like, a 12-year ACC vet. Like, when he and Boeheim had coached the same amount of games as an ACC coach. That was a fun time. Yeah, I'm not going to, like, I don't really care for Mark Gottfried at all. His team's really weird and enigmatic, and he recruits really well and then doesn't actually do anything with it. So that's fun.
Yeah, like, it seems like he's actively trying to get himself fired now, which is odd.
It's funny because it seems like they only lose in, like, ridiculous ways too.
Oh no, entirely ridiculous ways. I agree. What else do we have going on? I think that's really it for the ACC. It's weird. I think the team that wins this league is going to have four losses in conference play.
I don't see how they don't. Like, this it's too
it's more of a gauntlet than we even thought.
Yeah, and it's not even because, like we all thought it was going to be a dollar, but we also thought Duke was going to be, like, this huge thing.
Duke's a trash
Duke
fire.
Is a total mess. And you know, they've had, what, 7 or 8 different guys miss times with injuries, including Allen, who also missed times with you know, his other stuff. They're not what they thought. Though they might rebound because they're super talented, but... it's impossible to, like, project what they're going to end up being by the time the tournament rolls around.
Yeah, I don't know what Duke is anymore. Obviously, you know, this happened last time Kay was out for health reasons, where the team just kind of fell apart. I mean, they fell apart to a much larger extent last time than they are this time, but, like, between this, the Grayson Allen stuff, the injuries, there's a lot of reason to question the Blue Devils. Unfortunately, if everybody gets healthy and if Krzyzewski's back and also healthy and of sound mind and body and everything, Duke is the type of team. Like, this feels like one of those idiotic Duke seasons where, like, Duke gets seeded as a 4 seed in the easiest bracket and then just, like, completely tears through teams because they weren't seeded properly.
That's definitely possible, which is, it's hard to balance because you don't know. You know, what happens if all those freshmen start playing out of their minds on, like, March 5th and Duke has, like, the resume of a 5 seed and they get, like, a 1 seed bump up to a 4 and then they end up, like, just ripping through the tournament? You can't, like, say that they should have been a 2 just based on, like, you know, they are talented. Like, so it's tough. It's a tough spot.
I would concur. And I think that's a good place to start some halftime. So, Dan, what have you been drinking?
Let's see. We had... Not, I think we covered a lot of the interesting stuff last week. I've just been kind of pulled by standards recently. The one new thing I did try was Sierra Nevada has, like, a tropical version of their Torpedo IPA, which is interesting.
I saw that on shelves. I didn't drink it then.
I think I like the regular one better. It's interesting though. I mean, it does what it's supposed to be doing well. I think it's almost like a little bit too dry hopped and also a little bit too tropical. Like, it tries to do both a little too much for it to be, like, really good. But it's worth a try. I mean, Sierra Nevada doesn't really make anything that's, like, bad, so. Cool. I think it was worth a shot, at least.
Yeah, I gotta see if there's any fresh versions of it sitting around. Some things from me. I popped down to Long Beach. Actually saw La La Land, which I was impressed by and also not impressed by at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Overhyped, or?
I felt like it was overhyped, but it was also properly hyped. So, like, maybe so overrated it was underrated.
I really enjoyed it, but it's, like, I don't quite get where people are, like, spellbound by it. Right. Like, I thought it was really good, really well executed. I think I probably a little hurt from, like, A, not being, like, an actor kid, which I'm guessing is, like, a lot of it. Like, if you grew up wanting to be an actor, I'm sure that movie hits you
right.
in a different place.
Like, if you love being romanticized by, like, a fictional version of Los Angeles and old Hollywood, then, like, this is the movie for you.
Right, and I've also only been to L.A. once, and it was for, like, a hot minute, so it's not like I have that connection to the city either.
The one thing they did very well was they gave a great PSA for our terrible-looking roads. Those were on full display throughout the movie. For those familiar with our decrepit freeways, local streets, things like that. I mean, they did film it all in L.A., so at least it got to put that on there and... showed you plenty of things you could do in LA besides the touristy shtick. So that was a plus.
You can sit in traffic and then get a song and dance number.
Yeah. I mean, what else are you going to do when you want to murder everyone else on the road while you while you sit in traffic at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday wondering why everyone else doesn't have a job? Anyway, back to the beer. Because I was down in Long Beach, I had to go to Beechwood, which I talk about on here on a regular basis. Had a bunch of things from them. Had Hop Jitsu, Alpha Bomb, their pale ale, Tovarish, their annual imperial stout with coffee, which is so good. And then had one of their new double IPAs, Delusions of Granger. That was excellent. One of my favorite beers of the year so far. Of the weekend, I had, you can probably find this near you, Stone's Enjoy By Chocolate and Coffee IPA.
I think I've seen it, I haven't had it yet, but usually we can find the Enjoy Bys.
Yeah, it's pretty good, it's pretty weird. It's like the only thing Stone really does well anymore is the Enjoy Bys because the expiration date on the label prevents them from sitting on the shelf for months on end. Had New Belgium's Hoppy Blonde Whiz Bang that I was surprised by. It was actually pretty good. Had Aurora, which is Modern Times' Rye IPA, and then also while I was watching the end of some of the playoff games over the weekend, popped into Simsy's down in Manhattan Beach and had Browage West Blonde, My First Rodeo. It was again another hoppy blonde that I had kind of as a nightcap. So yeah, it was a good week. It wasn't an aggressive week like last week. That was all birthday drinking though. I think I can be forgiven for dropping off a little bit.
Sounds good. I mean, well, I guess if we actually do talk about Chucks here, this is going to be a slightly more alcoholic than normal podcast.
Yeah, why don't we talk about Chucks a little bit?
Reading through the comments on your post, so that would just like, well, might as well get into this.
The comments on the post are actually pretty good, especially when we say Orange Man, Fighter of the Night Man had the entertaining Sean is dead meme.
I don't think I've actually gotten there yet.
It's like close to the bottom where Sean and I actually started expanding upon it on Twitter about if you had a posthumous movie about Sean, what would it be? So I said it would be called Haven Can Wait.
That's so good.
Sean went with Shine On, which also good, but I'm partial to my joke at the moment.
There's so many. Have we not had like a straight up just like Syracuse dorm pun thread at some point?
That's definitely an off season topic, and my off season is going to be different than Sean's for sure.
It may already be the off season based on this basketball team.
Based on this basketball team, the fact that the lacrosse team has like its lowest preseason ranking in quite a while,
which means they'll probably make the Final Four.
Yeah, whatever. we haven't been there in a couple of years, so it's time to go back. So yeah, Chucks, the that New Jersey real estate development firm proposed that they're going to knock down 727 South Cross Avenue. For those who are not familiar with campus geography and addresses, that is the building that houses Chuck's Cafe as well as Funkin' Waffles. Funkin' Waffles isn't getting the same press as Chuck's, and I feel bad about that. I went to Funkin' Waffles a few times and had a great time there. Had some great food, some great, I think they had beer there. And I saw a couple good bands, including one that did Nintendo theme song covers once. That was really good. But yeah, if I tried to make the point in the article today that while I was annoyed that Chuck's could disappear, so many other bars have come and gone before it, and it doesn't erase kind of the experiences we had there and kind of traced it back to the idiotic save queues nonsense from a couple of years ago. People seem to like talking about it because it brings together a lot of different age groups in the comment section. Of the bars that they had, and it seems that, you know, every 10 years there's a pretty hard reset on the Marshall Street bar scene, and we're coming up on that reset, it would appear, for this 10-year stretch.
Yeah, I think you outlined it pretty well in the post, and we talked about it, like, on the back end, and I think on Twitter people did. Like, people that weren't of drinking age between, like, 08 and 2013, I think is probably about right. Really didn't get, like, or they all, like, said, oh, Chuck's sucked, or Chuck's is gross, or whatever, and those aren't necessarily false. The thing was, like,
these
it was...
were all true then, but there was also a good yes. portion of it that balanced that out.
Well, the thing is, like, the bar fundamentally wasn't that different. When the new ownership came in, like, in 2014 or whenever, like, they changed the menu up a little bit, and they changed some stuff, and they fired some people, but, like, those weren't, like, fundamental changes, but... It was if you were there that time, and then a couple of years after you graduated, like, you could go in there pretty much any time and see people you knew, and it was just, like, such the communal bar, and it was just very special for that reason. It was, like, it was no game planning or figuring out, like, what you were doing on a Friday. Like, you were going to Chuck's, you were going to see 30 people you knew, you probably showed up with four of them, and you were going to, like, it was just... You know, it was the community. Like, that's what it was. It was, like, your Syracuse gathering spot, and that was why it was special. It was nothing really. I mean, the drinks were cheap and no, better than no. DJs, and the music was solid, and the food was cheap as well, and it was better than DJs, and it was, you know, Fagan's is... I love Fagan's, but it's, like, not quite the right vibe for the undergrads at Syracuse, so... I think just for that time period, like, because that was the bar that people decided, for whatever reason, at some point, that was where everyone was going to go. That's why, you know, you have this really emotional attachment where other people are, like, repping for Conrad's and 44's and Darwin's and whatever else. Like, I didn't know any of those bars. None of them existed. Like, in 2018, there's a good chance that Chuck's will just be a memory, or it'll be some new bar in some other part of Marshall Street that resembles nothing like the old Chuck's. So, yeah, it's, I'm all with, like, you know, we can say save Chuck's and whatever, but even when I go now, and hope I'll probably make myself go to Chuck's when I'm up there in a couple weeks, just because who knows if I'll be able to after, it's not the same, because you don't know 75 people there. Like, it's just not the same vibe. The music's a little different, and your name isn't on the wall the same place it was, and, you know, it's just, you know, it's mostly about you, it's not as much about the bar.
Did the music fundamentally change, or is it just kind of different? Because the music is always a highlight for me.
It's been hit or miss. I mean, I'm not there consistently anymore. There have been nights where it seems like they're the same. They still ended the same, I think. I think they still ended with Closing Time, followed by End of the Road, which it should always end in, because there's nothing else. But I think there were other times where it was a little more top 40, which I wasn't as into. Just, like, Chud's, like, this really fun... blend of, like, 90s nostalgia plus, like, just enough, like, current pop stuff, plus then you knew exactly what the last, like, five songs were going to be because they were the same every night. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, if it stays open, I'll be happy, but if it closes, like, I think you outlined well, it's not going to, like, take away the, you know, however many weekends in a row you went there in 2012 graduating. Like, I mean, I don't know that there was a week my second semester senior year that I wasn't at Chuck's. Probably more often, like, three times a week, but at least once. Like, I don't know that there was a week that I wasn't there at least once. And it was because, like, it was very reliable. It was a reliable place where you could go see a lot of friends, even ones that you didn't plan to see, and that was, like, half the fun of it. It wasn't like, well, we had to get these people together. It's like, no, we're going there, and whoever's there is there, and we are going to have a good time, and who knows what the heck's going to happen from there.
Yeah, and on a college...
Except that you're going to drink 350 pitchers of Honey Brown, which is going to happen, for sure.
You know what, and that's the thing, I try to tell this to people, and I know you know this living in New York now, I know this living in San Francisco and L.A. after college, like, the reliability of, you knew you're going to get a crappy beer, but you have to pay twice as much for that crappy beer post-grad, like...
Oh, way more than twice.
That's also true. Yeah, I just feel like... Yeah, like, even on the cheapest night at a bar in New York or LA or San Francisco, it's going to be twice to three times as much. I think, for me, like, it was more, it was about the memories. It was also about the fact that, yeah, on a college drinking budget, and for me, like, I was paying for everything myself based on whatever I made for my internship that previous summer. Like,
yep.
you had to make it last, and the best way to make it last was to show up at a place like Chuck's. And, you know, I mean... Sometimes drank more often than not, but for me, like, I was there from the time I turned 21, which was, like, the first weekend of second semester of junior year. I was there without fail every single week from that time until I graduated.
Yeah, I mean, I was there from, like, I think the minute I turned 21, like, I think it was a Sunday night into a Monday morning. I rolled up there at, like, 11:55, and, that was, yeah, pretty much, and that was my senior year. I turned it early senior year, like second week. That's what it was. Like, that's why it's very special to people of a very specific age. Where, like, if you were graduated in 06, like, it might have been there. I don't remember what it officially, like, reopened. But it wasn't, like, I don't think it was the place.
It turned into. And it's funny, yes. Too, yeah, because, like, the people I knew, like, the sophomores I knew when I got to campus that had fake IDs, would like, we're talking a little bit about Chuck's second year. Everybody loved new Chuck's. I remember one night in particular, it might have been like the NFL draft my senior year, where I decided, like, I don't know why we decided we were watching it there, but like we were. I think it was the first time it was like started on Thursday night or Friday night.
The first year where they put the first round on its own night.
Yeah. So like we decided to watch it there, and like it was such a chill night. They were playing, like, I think they played through like the entirety of Taking Back Sundays, Tell All Your Friends.
Chex is a bar was working through some stuff.
Yeah, working through some stuff, so just like, man, just had to get really angry about it. But you know what? Fantastic album, first of all. But yeah, they played through like that album in its entirety, and then I just like kind of sat there like with my buddies and my now wife, like just plowing through Miller Lite pitchers. And
now I really want to know who at Chuck's is like, if you were, again, during that time period, like the I don't think the bar staff changed. I think it was all the same people the whole time. And that's one of the big controversial things that happened when they changed ownership, is like they fired like a bunch of people that were very notable, bartenders and bouncers and whatever. I just want to know who of that group really needed to hear Ghost Man on Third wailed throughout the bar.
That album was so good. That bar was so good. And before I get like sad, we can move on. I'm going in March, thankfully. So even if it is on the way out, I will be able to give it one last goodbye. I doubt I'll be able to find my name anywhere on the walls. Or
I've always found it when I've gone in, but I signed like a couple different places, and I think there's one that remains somewhere. I don't remember where it is now, so that's not helpful. I might have to, like, maybe I'll bring a Sharpie. Maybe I'll sign the wall in before it goes down.
That's not a bad idea. I should probably do the same. I gotta get there early, though, like, before the undergrads show up, because I'm gonna get angry if, like... I don't like being around crowds anymore.
Yeah, I was there once. Like, the last time I was there, I think... I was actually with Andy Bredler, for Fans of the Site. And we actually had a decent time. That was since we had, like, a big enough group. But, yeah, it's funny, because it's, like, really no different than probably what it was in 2012, like, in terms of, like, numbers. But it's a big difference when you're not there with, like... 30 people that you know, it's like, oh, who are all these children?
Yeah, and that's how I'm gonna feel. And I'm like, I'm definitely get off my lawn type. But also, like, at one point, and this is like the last I'll talk about Chuck's, like three or four different times, my now in-laws went with us to Chuck's, and like, and they had a goddamn blast like the entire time. Like, that's the type of place it was, and I know that's not the type of place it is anymore, but to me, like, there's very few college bars that could probably pull that off.
I always loved being, like, next to a table of, like, people I probably didn't know, but, like, there was always like someone's dad had too much fun at Charleston, like dancing when no one else in the entire bar was dancing. That happened like a good boy probably once a month, and it was always a highlight because everyone would just be sitting there watching this dude, and it's like, yep, someone brought their dad to Chuck's, and he didn't know what he was in for, but now he does.
No, like my in-laws bought us like a couple times they went, they just like bought us drinks for the night, and it was like. And like they even joke because my brother-in-law went to San Diego State, and they said when they took him and his friends out for drinks, you know, it was like $100+ night. They took us out for drinks in Syracuse, and they, you know, everyone would be like pissed drunk in the group for like $40, and that was always a highlight for them.
Yes. So if you do disappear, we will miss you, Chucks, and well, I'll be up there for the Virginia game in a couple of weeks, so. I will hopefully get at least one more Twitch visit. I'll probably get annoyed really quickly and leave, but I'll at least get in. I will promise I'm going to force myself to say we have to go in, and whatever happens once we're in there, we'll figure out.
Same, same. Okay. So our topic for the probably last part of this podcast, recruiting. Dan, things have gone well of late and also not so well. I know we lost a couple guys in the last few days. We also picked up a couple of JUCO guys in the last month. I know that Ravian Pierce, Ryan Guthrie, and Nadarius Fagan are all on campus already. That's a big plus. Was that everybody in terms of spring guys?
I think so. I can double check.
We have the walk-on kid from Holy Cross too, Jesse Connors. But I'm not counting him at the moment just because he's not scholarship.
Yeah, 1 second. 24/7 usually has this stuff updated pretty well. I think in terms of who's
they don't have
enrolled.
Fagan, they don't have Fagan as an enrollee yet. That's what
okay,
I'm
so.
About.
Yeah, they just have the two. So, yeah, and then Fagan, we know. It was nice to get them, especially Pierce. Like, you know, he was obviously one of the bigger guys we were bringing in at all. And to get him on campus, and Fagan, too, is one of the better undergrad recruits, so. Good to death those guys in and locked up and ready to go for the spring. And then hopefully we don't have too much more drama, although we have lost a few guys in recent weeks, which, you know, you have to expect it happens every year.
Yeah, and once they get those types of... I mean, I don't know Daniel's situation, but I know Palmer's gotten a ton of SEC interest. I mean, he went to Tennessee last weekend. He's got some Penn State... He's got a Penn State offer now. So, you know, those are the types of things that right now, at least, we're still not going to be able to compete with just yet. Down the line, again, you turn this season into a bowl season or close to it, you turn the next season into a bowl season for sure. You keep growing what this team is and what the system is, and people see a proof of concept. That's when things change. Obviously, right now we're kind of just a promising animal. We're not a proven one. While you know brands like Penn State, who just got off a Rose Bowl bid, and Tennessee, who just got off a 9 or 10 win season. You know, teams like that obviously have a little bit more to give kids, even if the system isn't the same.
Yeah, I think Penn State, not that we were like super battling Penn State for a lot of guys, I know we've won a couple of those over the years, but they've kind of been a good tier or two above us in recruiting for a while, so I don't know how much of an issue that is. Maybe it just makes a couple, a couple of guys that we would have been involved with a little harder to get, but overall, like, and the UConn news might actually be even more interesting, but they're at least impactful in terms of guys that Syracuse go after, but they're still not, I mean, I don't think Edsel's going to bump their recruiting up to where Syracuse is. I just think UConn's a really hard situation, and it's not like Edsel was really killing it in recruiting when he was there last time, when Syracuse and UConn were in the same league. So I think there's a pretty big distance. I mean, even BC doesn't like recruit. I guess they're pretty similar in terms of like where the rankings are to Syracuse, but I think things are different enough there where it's like kind of weird that Syracuse's recruiting rivals really aren't totally the geographicals.
And not at all the basketball recruiting rivals.
No. It's like it's a weird group of like, I guess Maryland in there, like, which I guess is kind of geographic based on where Syracuse has to recruit. And like you'll get a little bit of BC, but we really don't recruit that many of the same kids. Pitt, I guess, more... which makes sense, and then, you know, like the Indianas, I mean, everyone's down in Florida, so that's just a total crapshoot, but it is funny, like, you know, when you cite, like, the other Northeastern programs, a few of them that there are, like all the programs are so different now that it's really hard. And it'll be interesting to see what UConn does look like, at least because of the Rhett Lashley news, which I had actually forgotten about until just now. By the way, I don't think that's going to be a total game changer, although they might be in the position to kind of at least offer something, not the same, the two offenses aren't like the same thing, but at least they're like similar enough where it's not like UConn's just going to be this like rock fight, ground and pound team.
Agreed. So I know Ari, and this is just kind of teaser stuff for the site, Ari's working on a piece about some of our recruiting targets and who's left and how many spots we have. I think we have like 6 or 7 spots remaining. So we do have some space. I don't know if we're necessarily going to fill them all at this point. I know we've had a lot of our visitors lately for football have been juniors. So the guys that are, you know, not ready to commit yet, but could be potential January enrollees next year. It seems like we're doing well with those kids. We had a couple football visitors of late, but I don't think enough to fill all of these spots, which I guess that's fine. I'm not going to be overly, you know, at the end of the day, I'd love to have every roster spot be filled. I don't think we've had that in a while. That's what happens when you have coaching change and attrition and personnel issues and guys not getting to campus. Hopefully that all goes away soon and we can finally fill out a full roster of players. But at the same time, like, if we focus in on the kids that are still in the fold and guys that look like they're pretty fully committed, it's an exciting class. I mean, the first time in a while, Dan, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that like almost everybody's a 3-star at least. DeVito obviously is a 3 or 4-star depending on who you ask. But yeah, this to me feels like our first true like Power 5 class. Like, it took us a while, but like here we are now with a class coming in that is largely 3-star guys and guys who should be playing at not just at this level, but you know, in this conference and against these opponents. I feel like Schaefer had some of those guys, but others were a stretch. I feel like before he was let go, he was starting to bring in some guys like that, but it still wasn't to the numbers that we were kind of hoping for. But yeah, I feel like with Babers, he's definitely put an emphasis on those types of guys. And then for the guys who aren't necessarily Power 5 guys, just on their face, they're guys that distinctly fit the system. So I'll definitely take that. Over, you know, maybe trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, but because he has the quote-unquote stars or whatever the offers that we go after him instead.
Yeah, I think the two that I can think of that are similar would probably be, and this is like talking about like signing day similar, the 2014 class, which was Schaefer's first full cycle, which is a weird one because I feel like a lot of the best guys in that class never even came close to making it to campus. Correct. Or flamed out when they got here, or the classes did not have a big impact.
2015, I think we've actually, which is part of the issue.
Yeah, which like isn't entirely Schaefer's fault or anything. It's just like bad luck / miscalculations / whatever else. The whole George McDonald thing, where who knows, like what? Yeah, just a lot of issues.
Would still murder me, I'm sure. If he saw me.
Where is he now? Is he still? He's not still at NC State, is he?
I think he is.
Is he?
I think I am. I'm almost positive he is.
Huh.
I don't know why. It's not like NC State's had like phenomenal receivers or anything. Like, other than McClendon, like, I can't really, like, not McClendon. Who the hell, what's his name? Samuels. Who was like...
He is still at NC State.
Yeah. Samuels, like, the only, like, pass catcher that I'm, like, really raving about for them in the last couple of years, I mean, while he's been there. But they've also had a lot of turnover on the offensive side of the coaching staff.
Yeah, including with Matt Canada, now the $1.5 million man at LSU.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that class, and then a couple years before, or actually, I guess a year before, the 2012, what would have been the 2013 Marone class, which was shaping up to be a really, really good class.
That class would have qualified and then some.
Yeah, and this you'll enjoy this. That class would have been awesome, and then Marone left for Buffalo, and a lot of those big guys, including Gus Edwards, left the class, and he ended up going to Miami. They had a couple other big, high-profile guys commit elsewhere, and then, you know, they salvaged it the best they could, but it was obviously not, you know, what it would have been. But I think that class, if Marone had stayed, would have been probably the best one Syracuse had had in a while. Instead, it was like, there were some decent players, but it was, you know, it's always hard when you have a trip to leave. Those transition classes are always rough.
We'll leave that late, too, and I think that was the difference. I think, like, Babers was able to salvage something decent out of last year because he pretty much just hit hard reset. He knew the guys that he'd already, because he was a head coach already, he knew the guys that he had gone after for Bowling Green that he didn't have a shot at because he was at a MAC school, and he just got back in touch with a lot of those guys and was able to resurrect a class pretty much at a nothing that was hanging around the top 50 to 55, which I think was a modest goal and one that he hit and then some. And to be honest, I know we've been critical of Schaefer. I think that Schaefer would have been better off if Marone had left before the bowl game. But at the same time, I'm not sure Schaefer would have been the pick if Marone had left before the bowl game. Marone left right around the new year. That left about a month until National Signing Day. Bringing Schaefer on for a continuity hire was a good idea in theory. But because Marone left so late, and because he brought so many assistants with him, it wasn't in the cards for Schaefer to be able to really pull together a legitimate class. So there's two reasons why we didn't have a legit class for 2013. And then obviously 2014 and 15, some miscalculations. A lot of guys didn't hit campus. A lot of guys have left since. That's how we kind of end up with personnel issues. I actually think that the remaining half of the 2015 class and then the 2016 class for Babers, at least right now, seem like building blocks toward us finally having a full roster for what feels like the first time in, I don't know, a decade and a half.
Yeah, I think we were just getting there at the end of Marone, and it just fell apart, obviously, because you had a short class. And then I think, you know, if we had held on to Schaefer for another year, we probably would have gotten to, like, those numbers, but the quality wasn't there, and the offense was a total mess, and, like, the roster construction wasn't healthy.
Right.
So we're, like, kind of inching our way there. I think having a cohesive identity on both sides of the ball, even if, like, the actual development isn't there, helps a lot, because then you know, like, what guys are in what positions and who's playing where. Where, like, even when Schaefer had numbers, you had guys recruited for, like, three or four different offenses.
Yeah, not helpful at all. You hinted at Gus Edwards. I figure we kind of close out with that. For those who didn't see on the site, Gus Edwards announced that he was leaving Miami today. He was a pretty heralded guy coming in. He was a Syracuse commit until, like, late January of 2013, and then he chose between Miami and Florida State. He went with Miami. He never really became the back that they thought he was going to be. That wasn't necessarily his fault. In 2015, he missed most of the season, if not the entire season. He obviously had to battle with guys like Joe Yerby. Names escape me on a couple other guys that he...
Mark Walton. Oh, yeah. I think, well, he actually was the main backup, I think, to Duke Johnson freshman year. He was good when it's weird, just he's been good when he's played. It's just like...
Consistent.
Miami's backfield's been really loaded, and then he's also had injury issues.
Right.
So, like, he ended up... I think he's sitting at, for his, you know, Miami career, he's been around 300 yards every... 970 over three seasons, 12 touchdowns. His first 2 years, like, he had 66 carries for... You know, he's been over 5 yards a carry for his career. A nice option near the end zone. But there's always been a lot of guys. Yeah. It'd be nice, considering, like, what the make. He'd be a nice compliment to the backfield. I think he would add a lot because of the bats we have on the team. There just isn't a guy that quite runs like Edwards.
Right. And to catch listeners up, and we addressed all this in the article, too. Again, he was a Syracuse commit. He ended up flipping over to Miami. He's 6'1". He's 230. Nobody on the team or incoming at the running back position would fit that bill. He's a fifth-year transfer, so he'd be able to play right away. Again, three-star guy out of high school.
He's like a high three, too. He was like one of those closer to being a four than a lot of others, if you are into that.
And Staten Island native. So he's a guy that, you know, he was part of that kind of, you know, Marone's focus on New York City and the surrounding areas. Like, he's a guy that as soon as they saw the name and others put the two and two together as well, the fact that he was once committed, the fact that he's a New York State product, the fact that he'd get a lot of opportunities in this offense. I mean, it doesn't fix the offensive line issues overnight, but at the same time, like, having a guy who really runs between the tackles the way Babers needs them to, would help this entire offense a ton. It would also free up Strickland or Neal, maybe both, to split out wide, maybe play some of that insider receiver position that's going to get freed up with Grizzly Esteem's graduation. So, yeah, we'll see. I think, like you said and I said, I think he would be a great addition. We haven't really heard any hard news about him coming here yet. This is all speculation, but fun speculation, and speculation that lends itself to logic, which is always preferred over, like, wild speculation.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it would make sense for both sides. Obviously, Edwards liked Syracuse enough. A lot of that was Marone and Selmo and the staff. But he liked Syracuse enough at a time to be... I think he would have made it here if Marone had stayed. I don't think there's any real question about that. It didn't seem like he was wavering until Marone left. And you have to assume, you know, if he's building a list of possible schools... I don't see why Syracuse wouldn't be at least considered on there. Now, maybe he wants, he doesn't want to head back up north. Maybe he wants to stay down in, I mean, I don't know where in Florida he would go. But
maybe he wants to face Miami next year.
If he wants to face Miami next year in Miami, Syracuse would be a place he could go.
Yeah. All right. I think that's good for us, unless you have anything else, Dan. I know you're going to end with Go Packers or something to that extent.
Oh, yes. Go Pack Go. I'm going to be a nervous wreck on Sunday, and I look forward to it.
As you should. Like I told Dan earlier, I wrote an article about the Atlanta Falcons today for the comeback. That was not an endorsement of the Falcons, truth be told. I am not rooting outwardly for either team, but I prefer the Packers because I hate the Patriots with a passion, and the Packers seem like the type of unicorn that can beat the Pats in a one-game playoff.
Yeah, we don't have to dive into this too much because we'll have a full off week if the Packers do make it for me to shove that down everyone's throat. I think if you have the best quarterback in the game, you have a fair shot to win, and I think that the Packers have the best quarterback in the world. So, yeah, that.
I would agree with you. And on that note, Dan, thank you as always for joining. I hope your team does well this weekend.
Yes, thank you for having me, and once again, go Pat, go. I look forward to all of your supportive tweets on Sunday while I'm in the fetal position on the couch.
Fair enough. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and go Orange.
Go Orange.